Okay, we're starting here on the top of Pei Amud Aleph by the Mishnah. So Cherata Parada Chrosh Bahar V'Charash Babika. Person hires a cow to plow in the mountain areas and then ends up plowing in the valley. Nishbar Kankan, if the Kankan breaks, then Patur. So the way the description of the apparatus, the plowing apparatus that's used here, is that you have the animal that is pulling the plow and being directed by a person or an individual who's guiding the plowing so that they get the line straight and they get the field is plowed properly. On the other hand, there's someone in the back, right, who is actually controlling the depth of the plow, meaning that the plow, which is tied onto the yoke of the animal, which it's drawing behind it, and then there's a knife or the piece that's actually cuts the furrows through the ground. That knife, depending on how, or that metal, depending on how deep it's pressed, will determine how deep the plowing or furrows are that they are digging. And therefore, there's an individual in the back who actually controls or stands on that to control the depth of the peg. That knife or that peg that's in the back is called the kankan. So therefore, if someone was intending or had hired the animal to plow in the mountains and then plows in the valley. The difference between the mountains and the valley at this point seems to be that the mountains are rockier. And so the likelihood that the plow actual peg will break is much more likely. So if he was shoneh, but here he's shoneh lekula, because he's doing it in the valleys where the land is considered to be less rocky and less likely that it would break. And it breaks there, then he is patur. So the other way around, if he did it, if he had hired it to do in the valley and then he uses it in the mountain, then in Nishbar Kankan Chayav, over there if it breaks the plow, the peg of the plow, then he is Chayav, because there he changed the right to the Chumrah, but to the worse, to the detriment of the plowing situation, because there are rocks in that location. Ladush Bikitnit, if he hired the animal to trample, to stomp the legumes, v'dash b'tavua, instead he did the grains, patur. There is patur. Now the assumption here is that the animal slips, and something happens to the animal when it slips. So legumes are supposedly more slippery than tavua, than grain, and therefore if he switched to the less slippery work, and then it still slips, then of course it's patur. And the other way, l'dush b'tavua, on the other hand, if he did it, he hired him to stamp or trample the grains, v'dash b'kidnit, and he switched it to the slippier legumes, then chayav mipnei shekidnit machleket, because the legumes are slippery. So the Gemara wants to know, hechi delo shani ba, man mishalim, in the instance where he doesn't change, who pays? So the assumption here, Rashi mentions this assumption in the Mishnah, and Tosfos mentions it over here on this line in the Gemara, that the para, when it comes, we just said before that there's the animal itself that's pulling the plow, there's the plow, plus there are two drivers, a driver that leads the plow, leads the cow itself, and the controller of the actual plow, the depth and the cutting of the plow into the ground. So there are actually three people involved, two people and one animal that are involved in the plowing scenario here. The assumption is that when the person rents the cow and the plow, he's also renting the two workers that come along with him, that they belong to the balabait, they belong to the balapar, and therefore they come as a package, it's a package deal. He hires the par, the plow, and the two workers that run the plow. So in that package deal, if he was not mishaneh, if he did not change the location from where he was supposed to plow, he hired it to do the work that it was supposed to work, and it breaks, right? It breaks, machmat malacha, doing its work, then he's not responsible. The question is now, the two workers who are actually working with the plow, are they considered pushim? Are they considered to have been negligent in allowing the plow to break? Do we place some sort of culpability on those individuals? And so that's what the Gemara wants to know. Echad lo shani ba man mishalim. If he didn't change, if he uses the plow for its intended purpose, then who is responsible for the fact that the plow broke here? So Amar Rav Papa, denakid parsha mishalim. Right, that the one who is controlling the mardeya, I mean the one who's driving the animal, the one who's controlling the direction of the animal, is at fault here, because he's the one who didn't keep it straight or didn't see what was happening. I mean, that if he's directing the animal, he's the one who should be looking ahead to see what's in the ground and make sure that it's straight and they're not going to rocks. The one who's controlling the kankan, the one who's controlling the knife, the peg, or the metal that goes into the ground to actually plow the ground is the one at fault, because he's the one who controls the depth of the plow, and he pushed the plow in too deep. He pushed it and therefore got caught. Had he been kept it higher at the surface, it would have been fine. So each one of them has a reason for why the other one is the posheya or is considered responsible over here. The hilchasa, the loch is the nakid mana mishalem. The one controlling the plow is the one at fault or it is responsible here. Vi duchta de machzaka gundere tarvayo mishalem. If it's a place where there's a lot of rocks, meaning before they start out they know that it's a rocky area, then both of them are at fault. And Rashi says the reason that both of them are considered at fault or both of them pay over here is because havidavar mutal b'safek. We're uncertain as to who is responsible here. Is it the driver or is it the plowman? Who is the one that caused the damage? And therefore, they both pay. Which would sound like, this is sumchus, which is davar matu al basafek b'shalmeim, right, that both parties pay. That's Rashi's suggestion over here. It doesn't mention sumchus, but that's close to the question on Rashi. Why would Rashi paskin like sumchus? We don't paskin like sumchus. So why all of a sudden is the Gemara, right, mentioning something that is going... Right, in the sheet that Sumchus doesn't even mention Sumchus here. Number two is, why is Rashi to face in that explanation? So Tosus on the other hand says, no, the reason that they're both Chayev was over here is because there's contributory negligence. They're both, right, adding to the problem. They both were responsible for the negligence or the problem that happened here. And therefore, they're both culpable. It's not that we can place the blame singularly on each, any one of the two individuals. Since they're both responsible, therefore they split the difference because they both caused the issue or caused the problem to happen. So I'm Rabbi Yochanan.
Is there a moment where he didn't deviate from where he was supposed to do? Why is there an assumption that somebody was negligent? It's just the way it was. The amount is rocky terrain.
Right, so the expectation is that experienced drivers and plowers will know to raise the plow in areas so that they don't hit the rocks. And to drive around the rocks, meaning that there's a general assumption that one can plow in these areas, and if they take care, they won't break the plow. And that's it, the underlying assumption of the Gemara here, that one is capable of plowing without breaking the plow. All right. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mocher para lechaviro v'amarlo. Person sells his cow to a friend, and he says to him, Parozu nagchanit. This is a really special cow. It is, right, gores frequently. He nashchanit, bites all the time. He batanit, kicks. Right? He rabsanit, it collapses under its loads. I mean, it's got the works. This is a cow that has everything wrong with it. Then, vayaba mum echad, right? And there was actually one of these mumim, but sampo mena mumim. So one of these was actually true, but not all of them. So he basically incorporated, it's like these disclaimers, you know, that they have at the end of any advertisement or anytime you sign a waiver agreement, you sign a waiver for all the things that could possibly go wrong. So that's exactly what this individual did. He came along and he sold him an animal and basically gave him a disclaimer. He wanted to make sure that he had no rights to come back and say it's a mekach ta'ut. So he basically said all the things that could be wrong with the para, gave out a list, a laundry list of what could go wrong. Then that is considered a mekach ta'ut over here, that because he gave him the laundry list. Why? Assumption is that he wants to remove any blame from him. And then this individual who bought it, right, that he starts to realize that it's maybe not a nagchanit. It doesn't go out and gore all the time. So his underlying assumption is once he finds one or two of these items that are not true, then he says, the guy was just giving the laundry list and they're not really true. So then he's not zahir, then he's not careful about the other items, because we assume since one of them wasn't true or two of them were not true, then they must be true of the others that he listed here, and he's simply having a waiver, a disclaimer. Right? When you sign the waiver disclaimer, you don't really expect any of those items to happen. And therefore, it's considered a mekach ta'ut in that case. Whereas, if he says mumze umum acher, ain't ze mekach ta'ut. On the other hand, if he mentions only two items, and one of them happens not to be true, then he cannot automatically assume that the other is not true. I mean, it's only when he gives this long list of items and he finds one or two of them not to be true, then he can say, wait, that must be an application to the broad perspective, broad number of items that he enumerated here. Right? The way Rashi reads it, you're saying, explain this mum. And there's other stuff that's in there. The others he does not enumerate. In that instance, he should have checked, meaning that the fact that he enumerated this one outside of the laundry list or out of the general clause, then you have to check up on it. That's the way Rashi learns it. Right? And it tells the quotes in the Septuagint, he mentions just two mumim. Achat. One of them is actually there and one of them is not there. That's not mekach taut. It's only when he includes it amongst a number of mumim that it's a problem. So Tosus, in quoting the Tosefta, says that even if he enumerates two specific mumim, and even if one of them is not there, you can't claim because one's not there, the other's not there. Because the whole idea that you say one's not there is only when there's a broad list of them that he's enumerating, or like Rashi says here, where he enumerates one and then the others he just puts together and lumps together in one clause. In those instances, Rashi says you have to be careful for that one, right? Because he enumerated specifically. And as Tosos is saying over here, as long as there's no laundry list, then that is sufficient to make it that it's not a mekach taut, even if one of the items is not present. All right, Tanya Nami Hachi, we have a brace that supports this. Hamocher shivcha lechaveiro, someone who sells a maidservant to his friend. Varmalo shivcha zu shotehi, really shotahi, right? She is not of sound mind. Nichpeti, she has epileptic fits. Mishu memeti, she's crazy. Vaya ba mum echad, right? Vinsafo ben mumim. One of them is true, and he stuck it together with the rest of the mumim. Arizem mechach taut, just like we saw above, because here, again, he's giving the broad disclaimer and not really identifying what the problem is. On the other hand, if it's this mum and another mum, again, Rashi's explanation that it's a single mum and then he gives a, right, a general disclaimer on the rest. Or according to Tosfot, according to Tosefta, that he actually enumerated two mumim. So those are classified as being not a mekach taut because you should have either been careful when he only enumerates that one, or you can't make the general assumption. If one doesn't apply, then the rest don't apply over here. So from here, it points out, the Rabbeinu Tam points out that you see that there is simpon ba'avadim, that there actually is a problem of mumim ba'avadim, because here you're claiming that there's a mekach ta'ut when there's a mum and an eved and a shifcha. So from Rabbeinu Tam just discusses the fact that in Ktubot, the Gemara seems to say that Ein Simpon Ba'avadim, or Rashi explains the Gemara as being Ein Simpon Ba'avadim, and this Gemara presents a problem for that because it's clear here that there's a Mechach Ta'ut when there's a Mum in the Eved or the Shifcha. Alright, now, Gemara Kadiz, Amalei Ravacha Breid the Rava, the Ravashi, Hayuba Kola Mumim Alalu Mahu. When it gives him the laundry list, and then it actually has all these Mumim. I say, what's the din? I mean, how do we look at the din of saying that, what is the problem here? The problem here is that simply he has a laundry list and it's a broad disclaimer, and so therefore the person doesn't believe him. If he doesn't believe him, then maybe when he has all of them it doesn't work, it's a mechach taut also, because the way that he presented the information makes the individual think that it's just not true. Or is it the fact that he enumerated all of them, and then the guy goes and checks and finds that one of them's not there. And since one of them's not there, all of them, he assumes, are not there. And that's the way Tosfos explains, again, above this, that he put one of them amongst the others. So therefore, that in a case where they're actually all there, he should be considered that it's a good sale, because he enumerated it, and he can't find one that's not there. So he says, Amar lei, v'mordechai the ravashi, achamina mishmei the rava, yubak olamim alalu, ein ze mekach taut. That's not classified as a mekach taut. If he enumerates all the items, and then in enumerating all the items they're actually true, then there's no reason that the other person should come to believe that they don't exist, because he hasn't found any of them that don't exist. If he comes along, each one of them he finds that's true, so there's no reason to assume that the others are not true. And we don't say just because he made it as a broad disclaimer means that they're not true. He can't make that upfront claim. He just said them all, and therefore I wasn't really believing him. I wasn't really so mechlan. I just thought he was making it up and just saying everything to get off out of the problem. No, if he enumerates all of them, and they're all there, then ain't no chanami. He is a good sale because he gave you all the information that you needed to know when he made the sale. Alright, Tosus goes through, that's why I explained it that way. Tosus goes through this idea that maybe the way he's expressing it is the problem. Like again, at the end of an advertisement, when they go through those, you know, fast language and they just say, oh, they said da 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 da, do you really believe that that's what they're, right, that that's really what they mean, or they're just doing it to get, they won't get sued in the end, they won't have a lawsuit? Right, you don't really believe that that's really going to happen, or that's really part of this sale. And that's why, I think that's what Tosfos says, that's the Havamin of the Gemara here. That the way he expressed it, the way he presented it, maybe the guy just didn't believe him.
Well, nobody can have all those things.
Right, exactly. That's what Tosfos says.
Does the buyer have the obligation to check the object at all?
Right, Tosfos does say that again here. Right here. Doma Mari Kigon Shalom Mum Ayuba, all of them, Avi Mechach Taut, Avopish Lo Badak Halokeach. Like Rashi just said, that even though the lokach didn't check, afilu be'achad, Mishum, Dharma Lokech, Mistama Kohani, the Kamar Litnahu Lukuhul. And like Shaul expressed, can't have all of these things. And that's the Havamina of the Gemara here. The Havamina of the Gemara is that when you express something in this way, it's so unbelievable that the person just doesn't take it into consideration. Gemara's conclusion is no, that if a person gives you a disclaimer, and the disclaimer is actually absolutely true, then fine. The only time we give you that out of Mekhaftaut is when, if you give a broad disclaimer, then some of the issues are not true. If some of the issues are not true, then the person starts to question the validity of the disclaimer. If he questions the validity of the disclaimer, then that's fine. Right? That's considered a Mekhaftaut. Right. Alright, person who hires a donkey to carry wheat, and instead he brings barley. Now barley is lighter than wheat. Right? Nevertheless, he is chayav. Then he's chayav over here. Now, tvua, v'avila tevin. Now then, if he brings, he hires it to bring grain, and instead he brings straw, chayav. And again, the straw is lighter than the grain. Why? In all these instances, are you chayav? Mipnei shanefach kasheh kemasui. That volume has as much impact as weight. All right, we're going to see in the Gemara. The Gemara is going to have a machlok, because we'll know exactly what that means. Lavi letach chitim. If you contracted to bring a letach of chitim, letach is a chatzikur. Chatzikur is 15 sa'ah. So you contracted to bring 15 sa'ah of chitim. Vivi letach sorim. And instead he brought 15 sa'ah of barley. Patur. There is patur, because again, the weight of the barley is beneath, right? Less than the weight of a chitim. So here, where he changed and he brought a 15 sa'ah, which is an equal number, right? Equal volume, equal or to less volume and less weight, then in that instance he is patur. But if he extends or he increases the burden, then he is chayav. And again, depending on the shitot and the gemara, we'll see what this means. How much did he have to increase or exceed the amount that he contracted for to be chayav? The excess by a gemal is a sa'ash, losha kabin lechamor, and three kav for a chamor. All right, so now the gemara will explain this. Itmar, abayamar kasheh kemasuitznan. That our Mishnah, when the proper lashon, the proper way to be written in the Mishnah, is that that a volume is equivalent to weight. Meaning that there's a trade-off, there's a one-for-one trade-off between volume and weight. Rabba Amar Kasha Limasuitnan. That Rabba says no, that it's not a trade-off, but that volume at the same weight, increased volume at the same weight is more difficult. That's the way Rabba learns it. So Abaye Amar Kasha Kmasuitnan. Rabbi learns that it's just volume and weight are equal. The Nafka Kitakla, that any increase in volume is equivalent to the same weight. And if he adds on an additional three kabim, he's chayav right away. So that means, if I was to, for instance, bring to a letach of wheat and a letach of sorim. Letach of wheat is 15 sa of wheat. Letach of sorim is 15 sa of sorim. If I was to place them on two animals, in that instance, I'm not going to be chayav, because number one, I have the same volume on both of them. And number two is, if I take sorim instead of chitim, right, then I am actually lightening the burden. So it's less weight, and now we're at equal volume. In that instance, you're not chayav. Then, if he adds on an additional three kabin, additional three kav of barley to the barley load, then he will be chayav. Why? Because even though on a weight basis, the barley is still lighter than the wheat, even when he adds three kav, right, a sa'ah has six kav in it, so three kav is basically a half of sa'ah. So he's now at 15 and a half sa'ah of barley and 15 sa'ah of wheat. And even though the 15 and a half of se'orim is lighter than the 15 of wheat, that is since you're chayav, because nefach kimasui, volume is equivalent to weight. And therefore, when you increase the volume above, right, the intended volume that he was supposed to carry, then you are chayav even though the weight is below. So that is the position of Abaye. And the way Abaye reads the Mishnah is, the conclusion of the Mishnah, Bekami Yosifa Masa'o, is a continuation of the previous statement. Meaning, how much, when we say that he puts a letach of silrim, letach chitim is patur, but if he increases the masui, he's chayav, meaning if he increases the volume, he's chayav, what's that measurement? That's the end of the Mishnah. The end of the Mishnah is explaining how much volume must you increase to be chayav, even though the weight is not equal. That's the way Abaye reads the Mishnah. Rav Amar, kasher lemasui tnan, that it is, when you're dealing with equal weights, then if the volume is in excess of the other, then you are chayav. So taka glitakla, we're talking about an instance where the weights are equal. And therefore, v'nafka v'tosefet, and the volume's in excess of the weight. So the way Rava's learning it is that you're not chayav, for instance, until you get equal weights of wheat and barley. Meaning that if you have wheat and then you have barley, if you increase the barley to the point where its weight is equal to the wheat, so in that instance, the excess volume is problematic. But until you reach equal weights, volume is not a consideration. So therefore, if you have a letach of wheat, you have 15 sa'ah of wheat, it seems to be that the threshold to get barley to be equal is 16 sa'ah. So if you place 16 sa'ah of se'urim on the animal at that point, they now weigh equal to that which the wheat would have weighed. So now that they're equal in weight, the 16 sa'ah, the excess volume now is problematic. Because now they are of equal weight, plus the volume is in excess of what the volume would have been chitim, that is problematic. But until you reach the point where the weight is equal, volume is not a consideration. Volume is only a consideration once you've reached equal weight. So according to Rava, which the Gemara is now going to ask, how does he read the continuation of the Mishnah? How does he read the conclusion of the Mishnah? So Taka Kitaka Nachal Tosef, it's not. So our Mishnah says, Levi letach chitim, Levi letach sarim, patur. V'mosif amaso chayav. Then he adds on to that burden, he's chayav, malav. What did he add on? Shloshet kabim. He added three kav, which will be like abaye. Where it says, lo, sa'ah. No, he added on a sa'ah. Vaha alak tani. Our Mishnah concludes, v'kama yosif. How much must he add? Ala masa'o v'yechayav. Sumcho zamayar, mishum ayumir. Sa'ah legamal shloshet kabim lechamor. So you see from there, the definition of the excess masa'o on this animal is three kabin for a chamor. And three kabin for a chamor is like shita to buy, not like rubber. According to rubber, you have to exceed by a sa'at to be chayav. So where it says, achikamar. Now, achikamar is that that last part of the Mishnah is an independent statement. It's not part of what the Mishnah was saying until this point. This is how you say, heichi delo shani chitim bevi chitim. In an instance where he didn't change what he had contracted for, how much must he increase in order to be chayav? So the way Robert's reading the Mishnah actually has two stages in which you could be chayav over here. The first stage is where you increase the volume to the point where the weights are equal, and that is since you'll be chayav, and that's the end of that section of the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah continues a new section, nothing to do with what we're talking about volume before, but it's simply about weight, which is that if you don't change, and you do what the Baal Bayit, you contracted with the Baal Bayit, how much in excess of what the Baal Bayit permitted you to do will you be chayav? I mean, that what's the rounding error? How much is considered to be too much? So over here you have 30 sa'ah, we say that it is, in a case where you have 15 sa'ah, we say 3 kabin. 3 kabin is considered to be excess, and basically that ratio which we're going to see now is 1 to 30. 1 to 30. You're allowed to have 1 over 30 in excess of the weight that you contracted to. Up to that point is considered to be within the realm or within the context of what you contracted. Above that amount is considered to be excessive. So Rava says in the Mishnah, that's an independent statement, nothing to do with nefach and volume. That we dealt with already. Volume, once weights are equal, volume is a problem. If the weights are not equal, volume is not a problem. And then the next piece of the Mishnah is if you contract at weight and you do what you're supposed to do, how much do you have to exceed the contracted value of weight or amount of weight in order to be chayav? That's the way Rav will explain the Mishnah. Tashma, Lavi letach chitim, Levi sheish esrei seorim, chayav. So this is basically like Shita Rava, right? Because like Shita Rava, because he contracted to bring 15 sa'ah of wheat, and instead he brought 16 sa'ah of se'orim. So it's a classic case of what Rava said in the Mishnah, which is that you got the weight to be equal. So here again, the assumption of the Gemara is that 16 of se'orim will equal 15 of wheat. You got the weight to be equal. Now the nefach's a problem. Ha! What would you conclude from that? Shloshet kabim patur. Then 3 kabim will be patur. So that who's that like? That's like Rava. That's a problem for Abaye. So Targum Abaye explains it mechikta. It's a case where it's machuk. The question is, what is this mechikta? So Rashi brings down from the Tshuvat HaGaonim, and that's what he heard, that it's a case where they were hitzliu, the wheat rotted, that there were worms in the wheat, and therefore that was the problem over here. There was worms, I'm sorry, in the sorim, and that caused the problems. So Rashi says that he doesn't understand what the worms have anything to do with the considerations over here. So therefore he says nearly, and Rashi changed the, therefore it says and explains it like this. Shemasa chamor letach umiditan tfufot. That in general, when they used to measure the volume or the amounts that they placed on the animal, there are actually three ways to measure grains. There's gadush, which means that you have, for instance, a kur. A kur is a, say there's a measurement that is a kur, some sort of big barrel that has a kur in it. If you do it gadush, means you pile up the top of the barrel and you big, even over the top of the rim. Huge pile up on top of the rim, that's a gadush. Then there is the possibility of it being machuk. Machuk means that it's clean, just at the top, only goes to the rim itself. Exactly to the rim, or a little below, and then you cut it off, and it's flat. Exactly, that's the measurement. That's called machuk, because you wipe off the top, you clear off the top. And then there's an in-between gary, which is tufot. Tufot is not where you're clearing it out, where it's perfectly flat in the top, but it's also not gadush, it's not piled up high. That's the in-between. So Rashi says that in general, the mididah of chamorim, when the loads that they placed on were done at tufot, that middle category. So over here, what happened was, it was a case where he did it b'michikata. He did it at the flat category, that they were machuk. And so that's what the problem is over here, because, therefore, nearly, shemasa machmor letach midetan tfufot, tet bat zayim velo mechukot. So mugi alai betet zayim mechukot, shemachak pachot gimel kabin. So that's why, when you put up a sa'ah, on the machuk level of excess is equal to 3 kavin of a tufufot, when it's piled up. So that's what Abai is suggesting. Abai is suggesting that the equivalence here between a sa'ah and 3 kavin, which is that what he requires of 3 kavin, is in a normal case when they measured tufufot. So that's, we need 3 excess akav. But when you do it machuk, then you're going to need a full sa'ah to get up to the same level of tufufot. Even though, again, according to Rashi, seems strange, because 3 kavin is half a sa'ah, so over here you're going to demand of them to double, right, the volume in order to get to the point where it's equal. That seems a little strange, because you're talking about a huge measurement, and gadush means that you were able to double it through the gadush. Seems a little unlikely, but that's the way Rashi explains it. Tosfos takes issue with Rashi's explanation over here. He says why he doesn't understand why he rejected the Geonim. He says that if it mitnah ma'al olich barzel or v'nim olich subin or notza, achinami dim yosif yei chayif. It doesn't matter. We're not talking about when you agree to take a certain volume of load according to Abaye, then it doesn't matter whether you kedin. You said to him, I'm going to take metal or rocks, or I'm going to take feathers on the back, because according to Abaye, nefach, right, volume is the problem over here. So since we're talking about volume, right, therefore, who cares whether when it's hitliu or low hitliu, that makes a difference. The nefach, everything about the nefach is different over here, because you changed from what you were supposed to carry. So since here you took a sa'ah more, you took more than you were supposed to carry, then you're out of line, even though technically the hitliu, when it rotted, the density or the packing of the item or the amount there is not so much, because they're rotted and there are worms in it, so it's not really as much as a sa'ah. Nevertheless, because you were in excess of what you contracted, therefore you should be chayav over here. Right now, the Gemara is going to say basically, which is that this ratio of 1 to 30 applies in all different people. Tanarabanon, kav lekatef, when it comes to a human being, you get an extra kav. You're allowed to load him up to an extra kav. That's considered to be normal. Above that point, it's considered that you've exceeded the volume that you're permitted to put on his back. So if you say that relationship of a kav, then you learn that a person's carrying volume, or the person can carry is 5 sa'ah. Right? 5 sa'ah is 30 kavin. So a person, from this, you can learn is 1 to 30. 1 to 30 would mean 1 sa'ah. 30 kavin is normal carrying, which is 5 sa'ah. Adriv, when you're talking about a letach, 15 sa'ah la'areva. We're talking about a small boat, right? Then we're talking about a letach. Excess is considered to be a letach. Kor is fina, right? It's a, Kor is considered to be the amount of a sfina, and shloshet korim the burning gdola, and 3 kor for a big boat, a large boat. So therefore, a letach that is considered to be excess for a boat. So that means if you take a letach, that's 15 sa'ah, right, for an excess for a boat. A kor, habi tosefet the sfina benonit, a middle-sized boat. A kor is considered to be, right, the excess. And a shloshet kurim, 3 kor for a burni gudola, very large boat. All right, so now, based on that, these are the relationships of 1 to 30 that one is permitted to add on. and not can be considered in excess of what he contracted to. Those are, I guess, within reasonable error, within reason of the amounts that you'd ask for. All right, Amamar. Kavra katev. Right, in excess of a kavra katev, right, imita delo matzi be bardatu l'sishadyo. How could you blame the person who's loading up another human being and he places more than a kav, an excess of a kav above what he normally carries, then he's considered to be, right, in violation of what he contracted for. How could that be? You have a bardat. It's okay, when you're talking about an inanimate object that you're loading, the inanimate object can't tell you that it's being overloaded. But a human being can say, it's past my point, I don't think I can do it. So if that's the case, why is the individual who's loading him chayav? Why isn't the individual who's actually carrying it responsible to say it's too much? So one answer is, Amar Abaye b'shechavto l'alter. As soon as he put the amount on, the guy collapsed. He didn't have any time to respond to the weight, the excess weight. He brings on, he's got his five sa'ar on, and then all of a sudden he places another kav on top. And the guy collapses under that kav. So he couldn't react because he placed the last kav on top of him at that weight. Number two, Rava says, Afilu tem b'shloch avtol ha'altri, if he didn't collapse immediately, l'tzrichel la'agro yuteiro. Right, that he's trying to earn more money. So if over there he's trying to earn more money, then he wants to get as much as he can on his back, so he thinks he can do it, and he's willing to take it on, because he'll suffer a little bit, but to get the excess money, he's willing to do it. Rava Ashi amar, hu savor chushahu denakidleh. So he thought, Rav Ashi says, you know, he thought maybe he didn't eat his Wheaties this morning. He didn't have his breakfast. He's feeling a little weak. Not that he can't handle it, this load. It's just that, you know, he's not feeling his best today. So he's not on his best today. That's what's causing him to feel a little heavy. But not that he thought that he was overloaded. And then when he collapses later on, he realizes that he's overloaded. So because the person who's carrying it really can't be discerning, either because he collapses right away, or because he's incentivized by the pay to take more on, or because of weakness, he can claim, or he can, in his mind, convince himself that it's due to weakness and not the overloading. Therefore, he can't be the party that is held responsible or discerning as to the excess weight. It has to be the one who's loading him, that is. Kor l'sfina, shloshet korin l'brinei gdola. Amar Papa Shmamina, stam sfinot bat latin korin. From this, you conclude, which is what you were asking, Josh, before, that a stam boat has to be 30 kor. It has to hold 30 kor, because that's the 1 to 30 ratio. L'may nafkamina, what's that for? L'mekach u'memkar, for transactions. Exactly, if you hire someone for a boat, or you're going to purchase a boat, the expectation is that it can carry 30 kor. And I think that was what you were asking before. All right, Mishnah. Kol ha'umnim shomrei sachar him. All artisans are considered, or craftsmen are considered to be shomer sechar. Yeah, when they're working with the object that they are given, they are shomer sechar. The chulam shemru, at the point when they finish their work, tulet shelcha bevemot, come and take your item and pay for it, right? Then he becomes a shomer chinam. At that point, since he's done, and the work is complete at that point, and he says to them, come pick it up. Once he says, come pick it up, he's a shomer chinam. Shmor li veshmor lecha shomer sechar. They barter shmira, that's considered to be a shomer sachar, because just because there's no money exchanging hands, but since there's an exchange of value, that is a shomer sachar. Shomar li v'amar le hanach lefanai. If he says, watch for me, and the other guy says, place it in front of me, and place it down, shomer chinam. Because there, he did not acquiesce to watch the item like he suggested, but he just says, put it down. When he puts it down, he becomes a shomer chinam. The person who lends money using collateral, meaning that the creditor is now holding collateral from the debtor, shomer sechar. He's a shomer sechar over the collateral. That we saw, the Gemara has a machlok, is why he is a shomer sechar, but basically the conclusion of the Gemara is that schar mitzvah. That's what makes him into a shomer sechar over here. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, hilvau ma'ot shomer chinam. No, if he lends him money, and this is collateral for money, then he is a shomer chinam. Hilvau peirot shomer sechar. On the other hand, if he lent him peirot, then he becomes a shomer sechar in this case. All right. Abba Shaul Omer, Rashay Adam Laskir Mashkano Sel Ani, that a person can go rent out the mashkon that he's holding from a poor person. So basically what he'll do is he'll rent out. He has the collateral now. He'll rent out the collateral. And the proceeds from that rental, he'll deduct from the value of the loan. So he's basically helping out the ani. But using this, instead of the collateral being, right, just sitting in his house, doing nothing, if he rents out the collateral, he'll have to benefit the ani by renting it out. He can actually deduct from the loan and benefit the ani in that way by having the loan paid down faster. So that he's allowed to do. Of course, the Gemara will have to qualify what exactly that means, that he's allowed to, or what items or what objects is he allowed to do that. Alright. Alright, so now, Gemara says, Lema mas nisan to loka Rabbi Meir. I'm going to say that our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Meir. To Tanya, we have a brisa. Socher. What's the din of a socher, a person that is renting? Ketzad mishalem, Rabbi Meir omer kashom echinam, Rabbi Yehuda omer kashom echachar. This is a basic problem that the Torah presents three shomrim. The Torah presents a shomer chinam, a shomer sachar, and a shoel. Right? Someone who borrows. What's left out of the arba shomrim that's not mentioned explicitly in the Torah is a socher. So the machlokas tanoim here is, what is that classification of a socher? Is a socher like a shomer chinam, or is he like a shomer sachar? So why? What would be the reasons? The reason that he would be like a shomer sachar or shomer sachar is because over here, he's getting benefit from the item. So he's getting benefit from the item that he's using. So therefore, he's qualified as a shomer sachar. Now, he's not like a shoel to be chayv menunzin because he is compensating for part of that hana, or for that hana. So since he's compensating for the hana, he's taken out of the category of shoel, but he's still getting benefit, so he'll be classified as a shomer sachar. The other hand, if you believe he's a shomer chinam, that's because the reason someone's a shomer sachar is because they are getting compensated for watching it. Over here, he's not getting compensated for watching the item. He is paying to use the item. He's paying to use the item, right? Then he's not getting paid to watch the item. If he's not getting paid to watch the item, then he's classified as a shomer chinam. So now, the way our Gemara is learning right now is that they're drawing equivalence between uman, a craftsman, and a socher, and someone who is, right, renting. Why? Because just like a renter pays money and then gets usage of the item. So too over here, the artisan or the craftsman is getting paid for doing the work, but he has the item in his possession at the time that he's getting paid to do the work. So that the scenario is similar. Right? The scenario is similar where I rent an item, now I'm in possession of your item, and I'm paying, right, to be in possession of that item. Now I'm not paying, and nobody's paying me for the watching of the item, but nevertheless, since I have it in my possession, I'm obligated to watch it. And the same thing by the craftsman. Even though he's not getting paid to watch it, since he has it in his possession and he's getting paid for his work, then he'll be responsible for it, since there is what seems to be a monetary transaction, plus it's in my possession, therefore you're going to be chayav like a shomer sachar. So Gemara says, afilu teima Rabbi Meir. No, even our mission could even be Rabbi Meir. Let's differentiate between uman and socher. Why? By yano de kashovik kuliyama v'agir le'didideh aviyelui shomer sachar. Because you had a choice of hiring all different craftsmen, and you chose me. When you chose me over all these other craftsmen, that gives me ana that I'm the one that you chose. And that ana, which I don't charge you for, it's something that's an intangible item, so I'm not charging you more, but simply that intangible item, that intangible ana, is enough that he's meshabit himself to be a shomer sachar. Where it says, yochi, socher nami. Why don't you say the same thing by socher? By ana, the koshave kuliyama, umogre leili didei. He could have rented out this car to anybody, but he rented it out to you. So the fact that he chose you again is a little hana. Aveloi shomer sachar. So that can't be the differentiation. Ella, afilu teima Rabbi Meir. This is the differentiation. Since he can't be exact in paying the craftsman for the work that he does, and he usually pays him a little in excess, that little excess will be the payment for being a shomer sachar. Gemara says socher nami. About milo askinan to kamish avilei tvei purta. Again, why a socher? Is it so exact that you're paying exactly for the depreciation, exactly for the usage? No, you're probably paying a little in excess. That little in excess, right, is can be classified also as payment to be a shomer sachar. So again, that you can't break this relationship. Ella, this is it. Afilu teima Rabbi Meir. Bayna tafis le agre to lo bay the male ulam mepek azuzi avilei shomer sachar. No, there's a value that having the item in his possession, which is that he can always get his money. He doesn't have to go out and get paid because he has the item in his possession. So he has an automatic, right, to collateral to ensure that he gets payment. So that hana that he gets, that he doesn't have to go out and get, you know, make collections over here, because he's holding an item that will guarantee his collection, that hana makes him into a shomer sachar. That obviously is not true by the socher, because it's the other way around. The item that needs to go back to the balim. So his holding of the item is not necessarily guaranteeing hana, although Tosfos does suggest, why don't we say that? Because the fact that you're holding the item guarantees that you're going to get the work out of the item. That you paid for a certain amount of work and you're holding it will guarantee that you get the work that's done out of the item. So here, Tosus, in order to answer that problem and say, why isn't it that the socher, the renter, who takes a piece of property and is then holding it, basically the item, so that he guarantees he gets the work or the utility out of this item, why isn't that also considered a hanah, just like the socher? So Tosus writes, the end of the Tosus, last Tosus on the Amud here, V'yesh lomar, it's right across two lines up from the Gosa Bach, V'yesh lomar, du'man, v'adai ali shomer sechar b'mai de tofis ha'agreit, but the fact that he's holding it, right, for his possession. The fee, shrovum nim osim lacha b'beit balabayit. The most umim actually do their work, craftsmen work, in the house of the balabayit. V'inam tofsim keleum b'scharam, and they don't take anything for that. V'zesh ose b'beito v'tofus b'kli neneh harbe. The one who's taking it back to his house now is getting a huge value in the ability to extract the money or to get his claims paid because he's holding an item. Aval sucher, ein lo anash, kol sucherim tfusim b'davar shesachro. That is the normal condition of all renters, is that they have the item in their possession. Because that's what the rental is for, in order to use it. Ein yochim asum lachtam, yolo she'e b'shutam. So Tosus here makes a distinction between a sucher and a uman, which is that an uman normally does not have the item in his possession. And so therefore, since it's unusual here, where he has the item in his possession, that is classified as a hana. A socher, who always has the item in his possession, that's not considered something different that he's getting hana for. That's exactly what he's paying for, to have the item in his possession in order to do the work. And therefore, by a uman, it will be considered a hana to make him into a shomer sechar, but not by a socher. And that will be the differentiation of Meir's opinion. Meir holds that an uman is a shomer sechar, like our Mishnah, but not, right, a socher is not a shomer sechar, but rather only a shomer chinam. Right.
Then the Mishnah should be a usual case, presumably, and then it should be like a Shomer Chinam.
Right, it should be, but that's, he can say, Afilu Tema Rabbi Meir. A Meir can even explain our Mishnah in a case where it's the Uman's house, and you see that from the last. Kulam Shemun Tolet Shecha. The next line of Mishnah seems to indicate it is in the house of the Uman at this point, because he's saying, you know, come and pick up your item. So it seems, it might even fit better into the Mishnah that way. Right, so now Ibai Deima Kitabach Lif Rabbi Baravua. Rabbi Baravua flips the opinions of Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. He says that Rabbi Yehuda says that a socher is Keshomer Chinam, and Rabbi Meir says that it's Keshomer Sechar. Why does that help you? It's me. Socher, Ketzim Mishalem, Rabbi Meir Omer Shomer Sechar, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Shomer Chinam. Why does that help you? Because we have a Stam Mishnah here. Stam Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. So we want him to have Rabbi Meir fit into a Stam Mishnah, so that is why we want it to work in the flipped version, so that's enough to solve the problem for us. And now, Vukulam Shamru Tulat Shocha Bavema Ol Shomer Chinam. Anyway, comes says, take your stuff and bring the money. He's a Shomer Chinam. It's not Hatam. We have a Mishnah further on in the Gemara. Amar Lo Shuel Shalach. Right. So a Shuel, someone who's about to borrow an item, says to the owner, send it to me. Right. V'shalcha, and he sends it. Umeita, and it dies Chayav. In that case, he is Chayav. Why is he Chayav over here? Because the Shoel himself, the one who was borrowing, gave instructions to the lender to send the item. So when he sent the item, he was doing it on the cheshbon of the Shoel, and therefore he's chayav. V'chei mishah shemachzira, the same thing. When the Shoel returns the item to the owner, then he is responsible for the item till it reaches the hands of the owner. That's all if he returns it while it's still in the period that he was allowed to borrow it. So within the period that he's allowed to borrow, when he sends it back, since it's still on his cheshbon, the cheshbon of the borrower, therefore he's responsible for it till it gets back. Whereas if it's already passed, avala achayime sheilata, if it's after the time of the loan, then patur. In that instance, he's patur because mishakal yomei shemayim shuelala. Once his time has expired, he's no longer a shuel. So the way Rashi expresses it is that even if it dies in his own house, it dies in the house of the shuel, of the borrower, he's not chayav. Because once the expiry of the she'ilah happens, then he's not chayav and onsin anymore. He now becomes, well, we'll see, maybe becomes a shomer, chinam on the item, not a shoel anymore. Our Mishnah seems to indicate that anybody who says, come pick up your item, and then pay your money, you'll be a shomer chinam. Ha, gimartiv, shomer sachar. Right? So the Gemara seems to say from us, before we said that when you're a sheila, when your period of borrowing ends, then you no longer a shoel, you become automatically a, probably a shomer chinam, you become a shomer over it. Now, in our instance over here, the Uman, who is doing the work, when he says, I'm finished, why doesn't he get that same classification? When he says, I'm finished, that means that he should be disengaged from the item. If he's disengaged from the item, right, then he should be a Shomer Chinam. Yet, our Mishnah says, only when he says, come pick up your item, and, you know, bring your money, pick up the item, then he is a Shomer Chinam. Right? But if he just says, I'm done, then he's not a Shomer Chinam, he's a Shomer Sachar. That would seem to suggest that there's a difference between our Mishnah and for Mishnah further on. Why is that? The Gemara says, lo. The Gemara says, don't read it that way. The diok is not that way. Ha-ha-ve ma'ot v'tulot shecha shomer sechar. No, the diok on our Mishnah is not about come and pick it up and bring your money. Then you're a shomer chinam. Whereas, if you just say, I'm done, you're not a shomer chinam. No, the diok's this way. When he says, come and pick it up and bring your money, you're a shomer chinam. If he says, bring your money and pick it up, then he's a shomer sechar. Because there he's holding the item as collateral against the loan, meaning that he's basically saying, the fact that I have the item, when you bring your money, you can pick it up. Then he becomes a shomer sechar. Because then he's getting the hunt off. That holding the item gets him to get paid. He gets his compensation. About Gemara Tiv, when if he says, I finished it, my, what would it have been? Shomer chinam, he would have been a shomer chinam. Where he says, if that's the case, that's the tiny, v'kula, v'shamru, tula, v'shalcha, v'avei ma'od, shomer chinam. Why does he have to go? You could add a bigger chiddush in the Mishnah. Say, shmeinan, Gemara Tiv. Right? If he just told me, if a guy calls up and says, I'm done with the work, then he's a shomer chinam. Certainly when he says, come pick it up, then he's a shomer chinam. Because there he's telling him to come pick it up. So why does the Mishnah write the less of a chiddush? Where it says, tulet shulchait strichalei, we needed that. Sakadat chamina shomer chinam nami lohavi. That when he says, come pick it up, he's not even a shomer chinam. Mashmalan, that he still is a shomer chinam. Even though he's not a shomer sechar, when he says, come pick it up, he's still classified as a shomer chinam over the item. That he brings this, our Mishnah as a proof. That says that everybody who says our Mishnah, which states that it's a shomer chinam, my love, who adin gimartiv, and it should be the same din for if he just called up and said I'm done. Lo, tula shelcha shiny. Tula shelcha is different. Tula shelcha is different than gimartiv. Therefore, he's a shomer chinam, but if he simply says gemartiv, maybe he will remain a shomer sechar because he doesn't indicate to the item that the individual can pick it up. He just says, I'm done. So therefore, he might remain a shomer sechar in that case and only become a shomer chinam when he says, come pick up your item. All right, we'll stop here.